Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Philadelphia's doing it. San Francisco's doing it. Even Provo, Utah is doing it. You may not have heard the term yet, but you will soon enough. It's called Muni Wireless. Cities across the United States are drafting plans to saturate every neighborhood, every home, rich or poor, with free wireless broadband. Free internet access for every schoolboy and businesswoman. Today it's a luxury for the business class, but many mayors think it's a great way to hopscotch over the digital divide, to attract corporations, and they say it'll be a lot cheaper than digging up roads and laying cable and phone lines. The companies that lay cable and phone lines hate the idea. And there's another reason your cable and telecom companies are running scared. It's because of who is moving in on their turf, the little search engine that could, Google. This hour, On Point, it's the Muni Wireless Revolution. Listeners, you can join the conversation. What's in it for you? Is universal wireless service a luxury, or is it becoming a fundamental right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me first from New York City is Jesse Drucker. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who's been paying close attention to this story. Hi, Jesse.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good.
You and your colleagues at The Wall Street Journal broke the story of Google's proposal to offer free broadband wireless access all over San Francisco. Tell us about that.
Well, San Francisco for a while has been has made it clear that they want to offer some kind of wireless high-speed internet access across the city. Their plans were to, or what they declared their plans to be, were to offer affordable broadband access both in public spaces as well as some sort of signal that would get inside homes and offices. Google was one of several companies that submitted to the request for proposals with a proposal that actually went a step further than what San Francisco even said they wanted to do, and said not only will we do this for cheap, but we'll actually do it for free. So what this would mean if it comes to pass, because the city could pick someone besides Google, or Google could decide it doesn't want to do this after all, what this would mean is presumably that in virtually all of the city, both out on the streets and in the parks, as well as in your offices and your homes, that you would be able to get a free high-speed internet signal, not quite as fast as a signal you would get with a DSL line, like the type you would pay, SBC in San Francisco for, but something that would be, six or seven times faster than the connection you get with a dial-up, and most importantly, it would be free, and also the same connection that you're getting in your home. If you then had a laptop with a Wi-Fi card in it and you went to a friend's house, you'd be able to get it there as well, or if you went to a park or to an office. So basically, the kind of free high-speed internet would be everywhere.
And so push it one step further. If that were to come to pass, what would it mean? How would it change things for the way consumers work?
The most immediate impact, there's kind of several levels here. I mean, the most for the companies who are in the business of providing paid high-speed internet access, like SBC Communications in San Francisco, which is the country's, about to become the country's biggest telephone company when it closes its acquisition of AT&T, it's terrible news because you have not just a competitor that will be offering a similar service, maybe it's not an identical service, but a similar service for free, but it's also a competitor with a very strong brand name right now and, very good access to capital and the ability to, to really deliver on what they say they want to do.
That's the business impact. Talk to us about the consumer impact.
Well, for the consumer impact, I think, San Francisco, like a lot of cities, the theory behind doing this is to bridge the digital divide, and to the degree that access to the internet and all the applications that entails, that people who are living in neighborhoods either where higher speeds are not yet available, or who just can't afford to, pay an extra, $15 or $40 a month to get a subscription to a higher speed internet service, they now will have access, or they'll need obviously the most important part, which is a computer. But that obviously has very kind of big social implications, you know, for the degree that just, you know, school children doing homework and doing research are obviously increasingly reliant on the Internet. And obviously, the Internet at high speed is available in libraries all over the country. But to the degree that it's available at home and to the degree a lower-income family can get access to a computer in their home, you know, obviously that makes a big difference. And then there are also other, you know, kind of, you know, you could sort of argue less important applications, but clearly very kind of integral to people's lives. You know, to the degree that the speeds available get higher and higher, you know, being able to download television programs and being able to download movies obviously just kind of has very big impact on the way kind of people live the sort of entertainment portion of their lives. And, you know, also, again, to kind of return to the business impact, has a big impact on kind of the companies that traditionally offer these services, like cable television companies and others.
Does this, in terms of the telecoms, which I gather is your specialty, is this a problem in that people would not, the telecom would not have the same penetration, or maybe would not grow in its penetration of providing access, or would it actually eat away at their current business?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible news for the telephone companies, because in the context here also is that, you know, the traditional telephone business, you know, whether you're SBC or Verizon or Bell South or Quest or Altel or Sprint, the traditional business of someone picking up the telephone in their home is a shrinking business. I mean, more and more young people are going completely wireless. They only have a cell phone. They don't have a home phone. And to the degree that people do have telephones, you know, long-distance calling, traditionally a very lucrative source of revenue for telephone companies, is going away because people are instead doing free calling on their cell phones, or the local companies offer free long-distance calling, or they're doing email, or they're doing Internet access, or they're doing something we haven't even talked about yet, which is, you know, voice over Internet calling. You know, kind of against the backdrop of a shrinking kind of core business for the phone companies, they are relying on kind of two areas for growth. One of them is their DSL business, and for cable companies, it's cable modems. And they're relying on their wireless business, their cell phone business. You know, in the case of SBC in San Francisco, they own 60% of Singular, which is now the country's biggest cell phone operator. And now you will have Google kind of in direct competition to a large degree with, well, they're in direct competition with SBC's DSL business, you know, just getting Internet access at high speeds in your home. But they're also, to some degree, going to be competing with Singular, because to the degree that you can, that you have a device with Wi-Fi, and there are increasingly, we're seeing cell phones with Wi-Fi built into them, to the degree that you have a device that has Wi-Fi, if there's a Wi-Fi signal all over the city of San Francisco, you will then be able to use that to make calls. You can do Internet calling, you know, with a provider like Vonage or Skype or Packet8 or one of the kind of number of Internet telephone companies that are popping up.
Jesse, I want you to ask you to hold on a moment, because I'd like to introduce another guest. You mentioned Google, and we have with us someone who knows a lot about Google. John Battelle is the author of a new book about Google called The Search: How Google and Its Rivals Rewrote the Rules of Business and Transformed Our Culture. He's formerly the publisher of the journal The Industry Standard and co-founder of Wired Magazine. Welcome, John Battelle.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. What is Google trying to do here with this proposal to blanket San Francisco with Internet access?
Well, Google is the kind of company that seems to be capable of changing the rules. As Jesse was pointing out, there's, you know, a pretty significant threat here to some established business models in the telecommunications space. The same is true in any number of other industries. What Google's built is an infrastructure through its search application, which we all know very well. But through its search application, it's built an infrastructure of hundreds of thousands of computers and a lot of bandwidth. Taken together, it creates a platform that allows them to offer other kinds of services over that platform. We've seen them introduce Google Talk, which is a voice over IP application. And now they are going to begin to deliver, if San Francisco approves their proposal, Wi-Fi. And what allows them to do it is not just this massive infrastructure of computers and bandwidth, which they own. It's also the fact that they've got a very large network of advertisers and a program which matches the attention of people who are on the Google site to the desire of advertisers to get that attention. And that program's called AdWords. And the speculation is, and I don't think it's far off, that when you have someone connected via Wi-Fi, you know where they are. That allows you to do not just only advertising, but also local advertising, which is quite lucrative. And
Wi-Fi, I don't think we've said yet, is wireless fidelity.
That's right. The wireless, exactly, the wireless connections. So that, that you know, Google is in a position because of its, you know, those two assets, its advertising network and its infrastructure, to do things that, that otherwise would seem to be either too expensive or perhaps too far afield for a traditional company to get into.
But does it really need to do this to expand, or is this just something it's doing kind of as a test on the side?
Well, yeah, the question of whether or not the company needs to do it is an interesting one. You could argue that one either way. It can do it, and I think there's just something that is in the DNA of Google. If it can be done, and it can be done in a way where consumers get something for free that they used to pay for, it seems to them to be a very good idea.
Voice over Internet. Each of you have mentioned it. How does it work, just in a nutshell? Does it work well for the people who are using it now, and why would it expand with this new scheme?
Oh, Jesse, you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, what voice over Internet calling does is it basically it treats a voice call or treats your talking over the telephone like any other transmission of data over the Internet. So the same way, you know, you send an email, you know, from, you know, New York to California.
Jesse, let's pick this up after the break.
Okay.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll talk more. Stay with us. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Google, once a simple search engine, how it's moving in to steal business from the cable and telecom industries, not to mention Microsoft. You can join the conversation. Are you happy to see your cable company and your phone company cut down to size? Are you worried that Google, the Dragon Slayer, will one day turn into Google the Dragon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests are Jesse Drucker, who covers the telecom industry for The Wall Street Journal, and John Battelle, author of the new book, The Search, How Google and Its Rivals Rewrote the Rules of Business and Transformed Our Culture. Jesse, before we left, you were telling us about voice over Internet and how it moves voice like data, like email. But I want to home in on why municipal access, wireless access, low cost or free access, is going to sort of put that on steroids.
Well, because what happens now in San Francisco, again, assuming if Google's, whether it's Google's proposal or some other proposal, whether one of those happens, you were going to have Wi-Fi, you were going to essentially have wireless high-speed Internet access everywhere in the city. And so what that means is you will be able to not just access the Internet and browse the web anywhere in the city, but also make a phone call. And if Google has its way, you'll be able to make a phone call for free. So to the degree that you have a device that can make it work, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to carry a laptop around for the sole purpose of making telephone calls, but to the degree there are more and more portable devices, PDAs, and then we're even now seeing cell phones with Wi-Fi built into them, you will be able to do free calling anywhere in the city of San Francisco if Google's plan happens.
And would it need to be Google's plan, or I mean, as I understand it,
I say Google's plan because Google is, to mine, and we actually don't know the details of the other people that have submitted proposals. But I say Google's plan because Google is the one that has said it wants to do it for free. At least one of the others that has submitted a proposal to the city, Earthlink, has said that their proposal would not be free; it would be low cost, but not free. I mean, again, it's very interesting here that Google is actually being more aggressive than what the city even sought to do. The city sought to do something low cost, which is what Philadelphia is doing. Google kind of did them one better and said, we'll do it for free.
John Battelle, let me make sure I understand when we talk about free. this, from Google's business point of view, this is not, this would not be a loss leader, correct? They would make money on this from ads?
They haven't actually declared whether or not they'll be putting ads in. I simply can't imagine that they won't. And that's because if you look at the history of the company, the history is to make services like these free, to include advertising in them, and an example is Gmail. Google came into the market where 2 years ago, if you wanted more than a small amount of storage on your webmail, Yahoo, Hotmail, and Microsoft, that kind of thing, why you paid a small subscription fee for that right to have, you know, a place on the internet to leave your mail. Google came in and gave everybody a gigabyte, which is a very large amount of storage, free. And the quid pro quo was that they put their ad network alongside your mail messages, which actually was true in the case of free email from Yahoo and Microsoft as well. But their ad network is far more targeted and therefore more lucrative. So I would expect to see the same in the Wi-Fi distribution, perhaps not at first, but along the way.
Well, if I could add, excuse me, one thing there. I mean, Google actually right now in San Francisco is working with, and John probably knows more about this than
Fiva.
I do, but is working with a startup there called Fiva, which is basically enabling Google to. Right now, Google actually is operating some sort of pilot hotspots in San Francisco. I'm actually not sure where they are, but there are parts of the city where you can go and flip open your computer, and you will get, you know, you'll see there'll be a page for, you know, Google Wi-Fi or something like that. The company, what Fiva enables them to do is, it's connected to whatever the Wi-Fi, whatever Wi-Fi access point you're connected to. It will then generate, it has the ability to generate location-specific information on your page without you doing anything. So say you have your Yahoo homepage, which typically has, you know, the weather, you know, you've got, you live in Boston, and it's got the weather for Boston, and it's got the local movie listings, and I don't know, some other kind of local information. You would then flip open your computer in the Google hotspot, and you go to your Yahoo homepage, and instead of having the Boston weather and the Boston movie listings, it would instead give you the San Francisco weather and the listings for movies in San Francisco close to where you're located. So,
So let me pursue this with John, because it sounds to me like, I mean, Google already knows everything I want to search for, because that's the extent of my internet search skills, is I go to Google. Now they're going to know if I live in a city where they're offering this, they're going to kind of know where I am. I mean, it seems like this is putting if Google is my primary connection to the rest of the world through the internet, aren't they awfully powerful in my life?
You are ladling up a large heaping of trust onto their corporate plate.
Do I want to do that?
Well, we certainly, you know, the phone company's known where you lived for a very long time, and over their lines, your private conversations have run since the phone was put in. I think our culture gets used to this idea. Initially, we notice that there's a potentially large privacy concern. Over time, as those concerns don't seem to be borne out, we forget about it. And I get the sense that the same may well be true with the information that we increasingly store and send over third-party, you know, internet servers like Google or AOL or Microsoft or Yahoo. But there is a lot of trust that is inherent in this relationship, and I think it's the cornerstone of Google's brand is to try to be someone who can be trusted.
Jesse, is that going to be part of what the telecom industry argues to try to stop it?
I mean, they may. I think the kind of bigger battleground will be over just kind of the quality of service. I mean, they will argue that, with some merit, that a Wi-Fi signal, that you can't really rely on a Wi-Fi signal to get your primary, as your kind of primary broadband connection in your home or in your office, because, you know, it is wireless. It's going to break. The connection will drop probably more frequently than your wired DSL or cable modem connection. It's also on unlicensed spectrum. That is, all these wireless communications operate, you know, over airwaves, and the airwaves that Wi-Fi operates over, there are rules for there are rules for what you can do over those airwaves, but no one owns it, and so there are questions about, as we get, as more and more people start using it, there are questions about whether the quality of service will begin to degrade. And then, I mean, the other issue here also is, you know, an issue that I think, you know, kind of even the telephone companies, they sort of raise, but not entirely, which is kind of in the whole kind of world of voice over IP and, you know, kind of voice over Wi-Fi is to a large degree, you know, telephone service has traditionally been treated in this country, you know, a little less so in the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, but traditionally it's treated as, you know, if not quite a utility, then something that is heavily regulated because it is considered, you know, very important core infrastructure. And, you know, in the event of an emergency, you want to make sure your phone is working. What is happening now with the rise of voice over internet calling, and obviously with the increasing use of cell phones, the displacement of wireline telephones by cell phones, is, you know, telephone service is really something that is being left much more to the kind of, you know, whims of the marketplace. And to the degree that, you know, you really knew your telephone was always going to work in an emergency, you know, that's really kind of up in the air, I think, going forward.
And presumably in this new world we're talking about, a provider of municipal internet access would be somewhat less regulated than we're accustomed, say, to the phone company being.
Well, I mean, currently there is increasing regulation as we speak on the sort of world of internet calling. I mean, previously, until a few months ago, there were the same sort of regulations of tying your telephone system into the 911 system did not exist for voice over internet calling. That is changing.
Okay, let's hear from Scott. Is calling us from Richmond, Vermont. He's got some concerns about this. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. I was actually relocated to Vermont about a year ago, but prior to that, I worked in the healthcare industry there. I was director of IT for a practice management company, and I built out a 35-site wide area network that was wireless in the North and East Bay, and based out of Marin County, just right across the bridge from San Francisco. We were in the process of looking at Mount Sutro, which has Sutro Tower, which looks over San Francisco as a link into San Francisco for the practices there. And I'm sure this will all work in the long run, but man, I would be having a heart attack right now if I were there.
Because currently,
not to get too technical, because I'm not sure how to say this simply, but wireless currently is only available on a few frequencies, and each frequency divides up into a dozen channels. And basically, if somebody comes in and blasts on the same frequencies as you have on your Wi-Fi cards in your laptop, that would obliterate any kind of network that I would have set up there.
John or Jesse, can either of you address this concern?
Well, I mean, I guess the only thing I can say about that is, there are rules on the kind of, there are limits to how much power you can use, you know, on the unlicensed frequencies. That doesn't prevent, I mean, technically people can do this. I mean, they're breaking the rules of what you can do, but yeah, they can do it. I mean, look, it's clear that, you know, a wireless connection, as all of us who use cell phones, you know, experience, is just not as reliable as a wired connection. Now, you know, one thing we actually haven't talked about, which could change this, is the kind of the advent or the expected advent of a technology called WiMAX, which is very similar to Wi-Fi, with two kind of important differences. One is that will function; you can access it over much greater distances. But the other significant difference is that it will actually operate over licensed spectrum, not unlicensed spectrum. So, you know, presumably that would make it less vulnerable to some of the interference issues that Scott is talking about. But the complicating factor there is that we are unlikely to see the sort of the kind of viral spread of the use of WiMAX the way we have with Wi-Fi, because you have to have an incredible amount of money to be able to buy the licenses to operate over a licensed spectrum. So, you know, kind of the coffee shop owner won't be able to set up a WiMAX node or access point the way they've been able to do with Wi-Fi.
John, what do you think the city of San Francisco is going to pay most attention to in deciding whether to proceed with Google or some other approach to this?
Like every city, it's going to pay the most attention to politics. I think the idea of free is extremely interesting, but if, for example, everybody, you know, if there's some technical glitch that makes, you know, makes people's home Wi-Fi networks stop working, Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, isn't going to want to field those complaints. And if, you know, if for some reason or other I would put it this way, the plan that has the best political profile is the plan that he'll choose. And it will not necessarily be the best technical profile, nor even necessarily the best economic profile, though of course economics and politics are very close bedfellows. But it will be the one that has the best profile in terms of politics. And San Francisco, as you probably are aware, is one of the most political cities in the world.
I think every city is political, but...
If I could just add one thing here, I mean, in terms of, I mean, I'm glad kind of John brought up the politics here, because one thing we haven't even mentioned is that there's actually been a huge, an enormous political fight over this issue over the last year, where several of the big phone companies and cable companies have lobbied state legislatures, in some cases successfully, to make it illegal for cities to... coordinate or offer Wi-Fi services. I mean, the sort of most visible example of this, the one that received probably the most attention from the press was in Pennsylvania last year, where there was a tiny provision in kind of a big telecom bill in the Pennsylvania state legislature. There was a provision that would prevent
Jesse, we're going to get into that with our next guest. So
the significance of that is, you know, I don't really know the politics of the state legislature in California, but it's entirely conceivable that SBC approaches, you know, a friendly legislator in California and tries to get them to introduce a bill that would prevent San Francisco from doing this, because that has happened in, you know, a dozen states around the country.
John, I want to thank you for spending some time with us. John Battelle is the author of The Search: How Google and Its Rivals Rewrote the Rules of Business and Transformed Our Culture. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point. And I'd like to introduce two new guests. Diana Neff is the Chief Information Officer for the City of Philadelphia. She's been a key force in the move there to unwire the whole city and to bring wireless broadband to every home and business there. She joins us from Philadelphia. Thanks for making time for us, Diana.
Hi, Sheila. Glad to be here.
And also joining us from Boston is Ellen Daly. She's Principal Analyst for Telecoms and Networks at Forrester Research. Thanks for joining us, Ellen.
Nice to be here, Sheila.
Now, Diana, you are Acting Chair of the Board of Directors for Wireless Philadelphia. What is Wireless Philadelphia?
Wireless Philadelphia is a nonprofit corporation that was set up or incorporated by Mayor Street last March to oversee the build-out of the wireless network in the city of Philadelphia.
Okay, and how's it going?
Very well. We just announced this week that we have selected Earthlink to move into final contract negotiations. Earthlink will fund, manage, build our network, and create a revenue stream to Wireless Philadelphia to allow us to do our digital divide, digital inclusion programs that will benefit our neighborhoods and our low-income residents and businesses.
Yeah, why is Philadelphia pushing this? It's been very controversial, at least it was at first.
Well, you know, Mayor Street has had neighborhood transformation as the cornerstone of his administration since he came into office in 2000. We've done a great job of cleaning up our disadvantaged neighborhoods. We've removed abandoned vehicles. We've closed down drug corners. We're greening neighborhoods. We're bringing economic vitality back into those neighborhoods. And our school districts are, you know, unwiring their campuses. They're building technology into the curriculum. But they needed to reach out into the homes to include the parents and the children as a part of this program, and they were, you know, having difficulty with that last mile. So we're reaching out to our neighborhoods to help them, to bring economic vitality back into them, to overcome the digital divide and to ensure that our children are able to compete in the future, which is technology-based.
Ellen, when we come back after the break, I want to ask you what kind of business impact the Philadelphia Plan and others are having. There's like 90-some cities, I understand, are looking into this kind of thing. Listeners, we are discussing the new idea unfolding in San Francisco, Philadelphia, others. It's called Muni Wireless. It's got strong allies, strong opponents. What about you? Is this the wave of the future or just another old example of Rust Belt government getting in the way of the marketplace? You can join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the latest threat to the old cable and phone companies as the mayors of San Francisco, Philadelphia join forces with internet firms like Google and Earthlink to offer free universal wireless broadband to every citizen and business in their cities. You can join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is this good news for you? Will this save you money, or is it just a new opportunity for mega companies to make a killing? Our guests are Diana Neff, Chief Information Officer for the City of Philadelphia, Ellen Daly, an analyst at Forrester Research, and Jesse Drucker, telecoms reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Ellen, Diana Neff was telling us about what has motivated Philadelphia to get into this. Tell us what impact it's having on companies. Are we seeing an impact already on stocks? What companies are prepared for this?
From a competition perspective, it's very similar to the discussion we were having earlier, where Philadelphia, in a sense, was really the first high-profile case that exposed that these projects were real, that they were going to be put out to bid, and that the telcos reacted very, very quickly in fear. And as Jesse touched upon earlier, really reacted with a lot of legislative push, both at the state level and now increasingly at the federal level. But before going into the whole legislative, you know, action, what's going on is, you know, telcos really try to maintain their hold on the telecommunication as the telecommunication provider in cities. We feel that the telcos are really missing the point in a little bit. They're kind of coming across very hard-hitting from a threat that may be very limited, particularly for the next 4 to 5 years. And this is really because two main things. First, how cities like Philly are actually offering wireless service or offering broadband service. They're offering it wirelessly, and wirelessly typically means right now and on a best-effort basis. So insofar as the wireless signal is able to penetrate on the first and second floor buildings, maybe not even penetrate higher up, insofar as that there's no quality of service because of potential interference issues, because it's an unlicensed spectrum, as Jesse spoke about, that coupled with the fact that we've seen evidence that people who already have broadband access, arguably the more affluent people, tend not to go down in service to get a better price. They tend to stay very much at their service. And examples of this are Bell South offering a DSL Lite for a much cheaper cost, or Cox Cable offering slower speeds at a cheaper cost to kind of get that segment or that, you know, 66% of consumers who are not on broadband yet, and hasn't had big uptake. So we see the threat to the telcos are much less around taking existing customers or even attracting, you know, affluent new customers who are still just getting onto the broadband wagon, but really that it's addressing a segment and a revenue segment that is not clear was ever going to be a high revenue generating segment for the telcos, really the underprivileged. And it wasn't going to be a high revenue segment for the telcos because there's a lot more pieces of the puzzle that have to get in place before those underprivileged actually get access.
Jesse,
computers, et cetera, things like that.
Jesse Drucker, how does it look from your perspective, that point that Ellen
well,
is raising.
Sure.
I mean, I think Ellen raises a good point about existing customers not willing to change, you know, go down in service in order to get a cheaper price. But I'm not sure I totally agree with the kind of larger point, because I do, and Ellen can sort of correct me if these numbers are wrong because they're off the top of my head, but I believe roughly half of the households in the country with internet access have broadband, and a third of all households have broadband. So what that means is that two-thirds of the country still does not have a broadband connection. That's not just low-income people. I mean, obviously, if two-thirds of the country's households don't have broadband access from a cable company or a telephone company, and here comes an alternative way to get it, you know, that's not great news for cable or phone companies, which are traditionally... I mean, that's incredible. These are both industries that are traditionally used to having no competition. They essentially have had de facto monopolies over their core services.
Let's hear from Lowell in Waldorf, Maryland. He's raising a related point. Lowell, welcome.
Thank you. My basic point is, having been a rural liver for many years, the hills of North Carolina and the West, I feel that what we've done now is we've built these walls. The digital divide now moves from the cities, and then the urban user really falls off, because nobody's going to spend the money to continue to push better copper or better cable up the hills, and we know the limitations of Wi-Fi over rolling terrain. So all of a sudden your divide becomes a wall around the city.
Let me direct that to Diana Neff. What about that all of a sudden it's going to be, we're focusing all this attention on cities, but are we ignoring the rural areas?
No, I disagree. I think that we have pre-WiMAX today, which is being heavily used in some of the rural communities. You've heard recent reports out of Portland. The Indian community, the Native American community, has been using pre-WiMAX to connect their nations together. I think it's a critical, important step. We have several small rural communities that could become ghost towns if they can't get the telcos or the cable companies to come in and build their wired communities. You have Scottsburg, Indiana, that had two major corporations, a town of 6,000 people, and they were going to lose those companies. They begged their telecom and cable companies to bring it in. It wasn't economically feasible, so the government stepped in and are providing a high-speed wireless network, and I believe they're using WiMAX there.
But small town isn't quite the same as rural either.
But I actually wanted to sort of add something to that, which is actually, you know, I think Lowell raises a good point, but I actually think the full picture here actually is that this is big cities like Philadelphia and San Francisco are actually somewhat late to this game. The reality is that the kind of municipal wireless phenomena has by and large been a small town and rural area phenomena. I mean, it's been it was done first in places like Granbury, Texas, a town of 3,000 that I wrote about earlier, or, you know, this summer. That didn't have any DSL or sufficient cable modem access, and did a wireless deployment. So the reality is that I think that, I don't know kind of what the situation is in Lowell's town, but actually also what prompted the bill in Pennsylvania actually was not Philadelphia, because the original, my understanding, the original development that prompted the anti-Wi-Fi provision in the bill was actually a fiber deployment by a small town in Pennsylvania called Kutztown. So actually, you know, to a large degree, this phenomenon over the last two or three or four years has been a kind of small town and rural area phenomena, places where the phone companies and cable companies have not upgraded their networks.
Ellen, from a business perspective, if you think about how this may roll out, is it going to be concentrated in densely populated cities, or will it spread over the whole country?
Yeah, so we have seen, very similar to what Jesse is calling out, we actually see most of the initiatives taking place in more small towns and rural towns, but not always just for constituent access, you know, for bridging the digital divide, but really for just efficiency of operations, treating the municipality as a small enterprise. So instead of digging cable to run out a connection to a water plant, actually using point-to-point wireless, which, oh, by the way, also gives capabilities for the first responders to use in a non-crisis situation. So we're actually seeing the rollout much more in smaller communities who are doing it for operational business efficiencies, the building inspectors, combining non-crisis operations of the municipalities and local governments with the first responders. And that being really where it's starting, then they're expanding it out to guest access and then constituent access in sort of phase three. The city push is really, and as Jesse alluded to or said, is really a kind of a little bit late to the game, and we expect that these, if you think about Wi-Fi as, you know, sort of spotlights in certain areas in small, you know, houses and in cities, we're going to have hot cities. And those hot cities will most likely, if you look on a map, won't be in the high northeast area. They're starting in Buffalo, Minnesota, parts of Indiana. And then we'll start seeing sort of the high, dense population areas light up, if you will, in the northeast and in the west coast.
And are these smaller communities, and I gather some even rural communities, are they actually operational? Are they further along? Are they...
So the smaller communities tend to be sort of in their first or second phase of operation, which is they're using wireless, sometimes blanketed Wi-Fi, sometimes pre-WiMAX equipment to deal with first responders, to deal with inspectors and giving them handheld PDAs to actually connect to the wireless network. So they're pretty much along there. What they've also just started is giving guest access to downtown areas. Culver City wants to promote stickiness in its small downtown areas where they have a couple new restaurants. So they offer free Wi-Fi access with the hope that...
I'm sorry, promote stickiness?
Yeah, keep people actually in the restaurants and coffee shops longer if they offer Wi-Fi. So if they are using their laptop in the downtown Culver City area where there's a lot of restaurants, they're sticking there, and they may go buy another soda or they may go buy another Chardonnay, for example, really helping promote business in a very small town sense.
Let's go. Devin is calling from Worcester, Mass. He's got a question. Devin?
I'm just wondering what kind of security is on this. I actually have a DSL line in my house, which we've hooked up to a wireless network, a local area network. And one of the things we noticed when we were hooking it up is that we automatically located somebody else's who apparently has the same thing in the neighborhood. And we firewalled it, I guess is what you call it. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering who has access to stuff, transmissions like Wi-Fi and wireless network in general.
Diana, how would it work in Philadelphia?
Sure. There are many levels for security. As a part of our request for proposal, we had 17 different levels of security that we're requiring in our responses. We're going to secure at the network level. We're in working with our internet service providers. They will be required to offer a security package. You saw in the papers today that Earthlink has come out with a upgraded security package. And then as part of our outreach into the community, we'll be working with our nonprofits and our faith-based organizations to stress security, because security has to happen at multiple levels, at the network, at the application level, and at the home end-user level. We can secure the network, but if you don't put in a firewall or you don't understand that you're opening up your network to the outside world, it won't make any difference. So it has to be security at multiple levels. It's an important issue, particularly for government. As Ellen was saying, you know, we stand to benefit as a government. We're creating new revenue streams by leasing access to our city light poles. We can reduce in Philadelphia as much as $2 million on an annual basis in about year three of operation for the city. That's revenues that can be then put back into critical services. But if it's not secure, it doesn't make any difference. We need to be able to ensure our citizens and our businesses that the information in the business we're transacting over this wireless network will be secure. So we're building in security at multiple levels.
I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point. Let's hear from Tom. Tom is calling from Washington, D.C. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
My point is that government could interpret information access as a natural resource that is a benefit to society to provide en masse. And I think the argument's coming from the private sector of, I mean, it's up to them to compete with that if they want to, but it's government's right to decide that. And I think the argument from the lady from Philadelphia is very strong that that's what their interpretation is.
I'm not sure I follow your point. It's government's right, or it's a good thing, or...
Oh, I'm not sure. I think generally it's a good thing, this. But I think in any resource, if government decides to provide that to society at no or minimal cost, that's their decision, and they're doing it in the interest of society. And I don't really understand the arguments against it.
And I would agree, you know, the elected officials in a community are elected by the people. And if they determine that they've done their stakeholder analysis and this is a benefit for Philadelphia, as Jesse was saying earlier, 58% of our households have connectivity to the Internet. But if you look at that on a socioeconomic scale, it may be 90% connectivity in our affluent neighborhoods, but when you come into our low and disadvantaged neighborhoods, that's 10 to 25%. Well, if 30% of your population is in that low income or very low income arena, you can't leave that percentage of your population behind and be a successful city of the 21st century.
But Ellen, let me ask Ellen whether it's as straightforward as our caller from Washington says, that if the government thinks it should be done, it's a good idea.
It's a straightforward concept, and one that, you know, certainly I stand behind from a support perspective, but it's a complex legislation issue and really historical issue. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, we could have had a different telecom path here and elsewhere in the world. It could have been the government who controlled it all, and there wasn't a lot of competition, and arguably may not be as advanced as we are today. But fundamentally, because of technology improvements and changes, we now, telecom resources and ways to connect people are cheaper and they're easier, such that a municipality or a government can say, yeah, this is an infrastructure like a road is an infrastructure, and I have a right to franchise. You know, run a franchise where I can rent service on my light poles and basically make sure that I'm reaching the individuals. The challenge on the other side, though, of course, is that there's a long road for what the telecoms have gone through, and they have every right, of course, to given right to go and fight this because they feel that it will and could encroach on their on their profits and on their revenue growth and on their, you know, sustainability as a business.
And Ellen, let me just ask you quickly, are we actually going to see some brand name companies disappear from this effort?
I think everything is a time-based no, not in the short term. In the long term, I think you'll see a morphing of the brand name telecom companies to move up the chain a little bit, to offer a lot more services and applications that people want rather than just pure connectivity as these new competitors come in.
I want to thank our guests for this. Our Jesse Drucker is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers telecoms. Ellen Daly is principal analyst for telecoms and networks at Forrester Research. And Diana Neff is chief information officer for the City of Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
On Point is produced by Megan Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Consonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.